This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. There seems to be an explosion of books on happiness and how to be happy. There's the Dalai Lama's Art of Happiness and Martin Seligman's Authentic Happiness and Daniel Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness. We have The Secret of Happiness and Gross National Happiness. That's which country has the happiest people. Happiness is a choice and happiness is a serious problem. We've come a long way from when Charles Schulz told us that happiness was a warm puppy. Professor Sonia Lubomirsky has done something different in that her book really looks at the research behind happiness instead of just theories and philosophies. And it's also a very practical guide on how to be happier. In the first part of the show, we'll take a look at what determines how happy you are. And the second part of the show, we'll look at practical things you can do to be happier. Dr. Lubomirsky, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Is my perception right that we've got an explosion of interest in happiness?
That's right. There really is a great interest in happiness, especially in the United States and in the Western world. And a lot of people think that we've reached a point where we have the luxury to think about our emotional well-being.
So that's the why now, that we can afford the time and the money.
Sure.
How much of our happiness is genetic?
That's an excellent question. There's a whole field of research called behavioral genetics that addresses it. And I argue that about 50%, about half of our happiness is genetically determined. That means that when you take a lot of people and you ask yourself, why are some of them happier than others, about 50% of those differences are explained by genes.
And that comes mostly from twin studies?
That's right. So they're actually very simple. Well, in some ways, they're very simple studies. What researchers do is they compare the happiness levels of identical twins and how similar they are to the happiness levels and their similarity among fraternal twins. Now, we know identical twins share 100% of their genes, and fraternal twins share only 50% of their genes. It turns out that identical twins are much more similar in their happiness than our fraternal twins, even when they're raised apart. So these findings suggest that a big portion of our happiness is determined by our genes.
And you also say that there's a gene that heavily influences depression.
That's right. There's some very interesting work coming out of the United Kingdom and in other places, identified a specific gene. Now, there are likely many genes involved, but they identified a specific gene that if you have the wrong version of this gene, so to speak, and you also have stressful life circumstances, like something bad happening, or maybe you were neglected in childhood, the combination of having the gene and the stresses makes you more likely to become depressed. Now, if you only have the gene or if you only have the stress, then you're not as likely to get depressed.
So the stress or trauma or abusive childhood turns on the gene?
That is what is thought, yes. It's really fascinating research.
But as far as we know, there's probably dozens of genes that contribute to whether you're depressed or happy?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in this particular area, but it's pretty clear there's probably many genes that are related to both depression and to happiness. We just don't really know much about it, and they likely turn each other on and off, and then the environment, of course, is also influential in making those genes express themselves or not. So it's really a very complicated scenario.
Do you think in 10, 20 years or so we'll see genetic engineering altering the genes that tend to cause depression?
That would be wonderful if that happens. I don't know if it would be that soon, maybe in 50 or 100 years.
What's the relationship between genetics and set point for happiness?
They're basically the same thing. The set point is basically the person's baseline for happiness that is genetically determined. So some of us are born with a high set point for happiness, kind of like that some of us are born with a high set point for weight. And some of us are born with a lower set point for happiness, and our happiness tends to revolve around that set point. It's really more of a set range, actually. And so when bad or really good things happen to us, we'll get happier, we'll get less happy, but over time we'll revert back to that set point.
There are set points like on our thermostat that you set it up and it stays there, and there are things like metabolism that if you go on a lot of crash diets, your metabolism goes down and it's very hard to get it back up. When you do the strategies that you recommend, is that permanently raising the set point? How does that work?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's partly this is sort of a semantic issue, because I define the set point as what is genetically determined. So that's something that's just coded in your genes that you can't change, but it doesn't mean that you can't change your average level of happiness. And so I argue that people who learn new habits, they learn new strategies for how to become happier, and then those strategies become habits, then you can maintain a higher level of happiness than is your set point for a long period of time, perhaps forever, but it means that you need to put a lot more effort into it. People who are just born, they're lucky that they're born with a high set point, right? They don't have to put any effort into it.
So would you use the metaphor that you're overriding the program, or that you're actually changing the set point?
Yeah, I would say that you're not actually changing the set point. That's just coded in your genes,
mm-hmm.
but that you are maybe lastingly able to override it. That's right.
Or prevent those genes from being turned on, or at least tone them down.
You know, I don't know exactly how that occurs. It's really a black box.
How does seasonal affective disorder, SAD, play into the genetic set point?
I don't know if I can answer that question, because I really, what I do is I study happiness, and certainly people who are on the unhappy range of the continuum are more likely to have depression or to have SAD or to have other clinical problems. But those are really, I think, quite separate from the happiness continuum. I mean, those are syndromes that have their own collection of symptoms and have their own sort of biological origins or genetic determinants. So I'm not sure if I can answer that question.
So that's like a separate disease.
Yeah.
You live in Santa Monica. The people who live in Alaska, do you have an advantage in being happier than they are?
Interestingly, I think people who live in Santa Monica probably think that they have an advantage. There's a famous study that compared Californians to those who live in the Midwest, and Californians thought that Midwesterners were less happy, and Midwesterners thought that Californians were more happy. That was the stereotype. But actually, when you ask people how happy they were, there were no differences. So I think that partly has to do with a phenomenon called hedonic adaptation,
mm-hmm.
that I think is critical, which is that once you move to a place or you grow up in a place, you get used to it. And so you live in a place where mostly it's very cold or it's cloudy a lot of the time. The one day that it's sunny makes you really ecstatic. So, you know, when I first moved to California, it was like every morning it's a wonderful day. And then eventually I got used to it. And you really have to consciously use strategies to try not to adapt. You know, I really consciously try to say to myself, oh, look what a beautiful day it is right now, and appreciate it and savor it.
Instead of, oh, well, another perfect day, huh?
Exactly.
Many years ago, I taught a mental health course in college, and I gave a little assignment. I told the students to count their happies. And I was amazed that three students came into me independently in office hours and said, Dr. Bricky, can I just continue this assignment? And I said, well, what's going on? And they said, well, I started feeling happier, and it was scary, and I don't feel comfortable doing that. What do you think that was about?
I think people were uncomfortable getting happier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't meet a lot of people like that. I mean, there's some people that, I mean, most people I talk to or communicate with really want to be happier, even if they're generally happy. A lot of people, especially in the U.S., want to be even happier. And there are a lot of benefits to being happy, not just the mood, so I think that's a laudable goal. But there are some people who think that there's a choice between being happy and being right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as though becoming happier means you have to put on rose-colored glasses and not really see the world in a realistic way. And so that might be behind some of those students. And I think that's really, I don't agree with that perspective, because I think that there are multiple views or perspectives of the world, and you choose which perspective to put in front of you.
And if you're not realistic, you might be vulnerable to getting blindsided or being a fool.
Of course, yes, of course. But the research actually does not show that happier people are unrealistic. So there's some studies that suggest in some situations they feel that they have more control than they really do. So that might be problematic, but sometimes that's actually a really great thing because it could turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That when you feel you have more control, you make more efforts to do things that give you control.
Exactly.
Can you talk about some of the literature on how happier people are more successful?
Yeah, I think this is a really fascinating literature. I published a paper with a couple of colleagues where we summarized 225 studies on this topic, and basically we concluded that happiness isn't just something that makes you feel good. It also has lots of positive outcomes associated with it. So happier people earn more money, they're more likely to get a job interview, they have more friends, they're more likely to get married and to stay married. They're more creative, they're healthier, they have a stronger immune system, they live longer. You sort of go on and on down the list. And these studies are not only correlational, so some of these studies are longitudinal, where you follow people across time, and some of the studies are experiments. So you make people happy and then see if they become more creative.
So this is really good quality research, not just the quickie correlational stuff.
Yes, it is good quality research. Not all of it, but a lot of it is. But there are some gaps in the literature, so I would love to see more studies confirming or validating this set of 225 that we found. But we were really pretty confident in our conclusions.
So we have 50% that's genetic. The vast majority of us think that, oh, if I'm just more successful at work or earn some more money or I get my spouse to do things the way I want to do it, then I'd be happy. How much of happiness is those kind of things?
Yeah, that's a great question. I argue that about 10% of our happiness is due to our life circumstances. Now, I should say that none of these numbers really are set in stone.
Mm-hmm.
It could be 12%, it could be 18%. But the point really is that it's a lot less than people think. People are usually really surprised or even astonished at this finding that our life circumstances don't affect our happiness as much as we think they will. And again, I mentioned the hedonic adaptation, and it says what happens when you get what you want. Oh, when my husband starts helping me out at the house, when I get that job, when we move to that city I've always wanted to live in, when I have cosmetic surgery and I look more attractive, those things all make us happy initially, but then, as I mentioned, we get used to them, and then we want even more.
And we even see the extremes with that with lottery winners or great tragedies like Christopher Reeves. After depression, he bounces back and still a pretty upbeat guy.
That's right. And I mean, I should say there's a caveat, which is that negative events sometimes do permanently or lastingly affect our happiness. So the research on disability shows that people are, on average, their happiness is lowered when they have a moderate to severe disability. Of course, there's lots of exceptions. That happens with job loss and with divorce as well. But with positive events, which is mostly what I'm interested in, because people, that's what people think, you know, will make them happier.
Mm-hmm.
Positive things happen to them. I've not seen any research that shows that positive events have lasting or permanent changes without intentional activities that people would need to use to continue to appreciate those positive changes.
So if you win the lottery and you use some of that money to get a personal trainer and get more physically fit, then you get a longer lasting benefit from it.
Exactly. I mean, and it's sort of a cliche, but yeah, it's not money that makes you happy. It's what you can do with it. And if you spend it on experiences rather than on possessions, there's a whole literature on this, you're going to be happier. If you spend it in ways that really allow you to grow as a person, to contribute to your community, maybe to charity, to contribute to sort of your social relationships, then that actually can make you happier.
People who have trauma or disability, the ones who go back to their previous level of happiness, are they people who have better coping skills?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize it. People who are able to overcome traumas or disabilities are using very adaptive coping skills and strategies. I have one of the chapters in my book, The How of Happiness, that's what I write about, is sort of what kind of strategies are going to be most valuable to people when they are traumatized.
You talk about myths of happiness. What are the myths?
One of them is this idea that genetics is everything, that either you're happy or you're not. You're born happy or you're not born happy. And so, therefore, there's nothing you can do. And that is wrong because, as I mentioned, that genetics is an important component of happiness, but it's not 100%. It's maybe about 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other important myth that we touched on was that I will be happy when I have that perfect job or that boyfriend that I've always wanted or when I have a baby or when I lose weight. And again, those things do make people happy, but they don't contribute to one's happiness as much as we think they do.
And I like the way you say, well, I haven't found happiness yet, like it's a treasure hunt.
That's right. I mean, I don't like the term kind of pursuit of happiness or search for happiness. It's as though you're finding some object. I think it's a process.
And we have research that says money won't make you happier. Can you tell us about that? Because that's one that's hard for a lot of people to believe. I mean,
yeah, there's a caveat that money can make us happier, but there's some factors involved. And so when you don't have your basic needs met, when you're living below subsistence level, you're poor, money, yes, makes people a lot happier. And that's sort of common sense. Now, above a certain level of income, when we have our basic needs met, then the correlation between income or money and happiness is much lower. Now, it's still significant. So I should say that money does make us happier, but just not as much as we think, not that much. And again, now there's studies showing that it really depends how you spend the money. So there's one nice study that showed that if you give people money and you ask them to either spend it on themselves or on someone else, if they spend on themselves, they sort of return to their previous level of happiness at the end of the day. Yeah, and if they spend it on someone else, then they continue to be happy.
And we also think that if we were prettier, we would be happier. What's the research say on that?
Right, and I think that's pretty convincing research that people who are more attractive, more pretty, more handsome are not actually happier than those who are less so. And so that's another example of people believing that if only I had X, Y, or Z, I would be happier, but actually those things don't affect your happiness that much.
Did I catch that you said that people who were happier perceive themselves to be more beautiful?
Yes. So it is interesting. There's one nice study that looked at people who are happy and unhappy. They didn't differ in their attractiveness level. So the happy and the unhappy people were similar in their levels of attractiveness, but happier people thought they were more attractive. And so I think of this halo that happier people look at a lot of things more positively. They like their TV sets more, you know, than their unhappy peers. They like their relationships more, and they also like themselves more.
So it's very similar to optimism.
Yes, yes. It's positive thinking, and optimism is a sort of positive thinking about the future. But happier people are more optimistic, more positive about themselves, about the future, about their past, about the world in general.
Now, I was fascinated with your research on smile lines. Can you tell us about that?
So there's this very nice study that took a number of severely depressed women who had been severely depressed for many years and pretty much nothing had worked for them. And the experiment was to give them Botox to get rid of their frown lines. The result was that the majority of them became not depressed, and all of them at least reduced in their severity of their depression. And it's really fascinating. One of the explanations is that people probably responded to them differently. When you're seen as frowning, you're not going to be appearing as friendly. And also there's something called the facial feedback hypothesis, which is that when you're smiling, you feel happier. There's sort of feedback that goes back to the brain that's telling you, I'm happy, you know, I'm feeling happy, even if that smile is fake. And when you're frowning, feedback goes back to your brain saying that you're not feeling happy. So it's actually forcing someone to frown is going to make them less happy.
And these were people that nothing else had worked on. They had been depressed a long time, and 90% of them got better?
Yes, yes. So that's why it's such a... Now, I should say it's a very small study. It was a very small sample. So it would be great if it were replicated.
That just amazes me. So one of the implications of this would be just consciously choosing to smile more would probably help you be happier.
That's exactly right. I actually have a section of that in my book, that just trying to appear like you're a happier person is a good strategy to make yourself happier. Now, a lot of people will think that that seems silly, just smile when you don't feel like smiling. But the research has borne this out, and people who force themselves to smile feel a little bit happier. They find cartoons more funny. And then, of course, people respond to them more positively, and that might actually be the bulk of the effect, is that if people respond to you more positively, you're going to be happier.
The old AA, fake it till you make it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a regular clinical practice. I had some people that just didn't seem to follow the usual suggestions, so I tried to do something unusual. I told them to count rooftops and tell me what percentage of the rooftops in the neighborhood were red or black or green or whatever, and they reported being happier. And I think what did that was it forces them to look up. And I find that when you're looking straight ahead or up, it's hard to feel depressed. And when you look down, it's very easy to get depressed.
That's fascinating. I like that. Can I use that?
Sure.
That's a really nice... Yeah, it just shows that just how we carry ourselves, you know, whether we smile, whether we look up, our posture perhaps, I mean, that can affect our happiness levels too, maybe.
So we've had the 50% genetic, 10% situational. What's the 40%?
Well, the 40% is what's left over. It's uncharted territory. Colleagues and I argue that that 40% is what we have control over. It's that part of our happiness that we can control through how we act and how we think. And I call that intentional activity. So we might effortfully use strategies to make ourselves happier.
Well, I'm surprised you say you argue, because you have a lot of data supporting that each of the strategies that you recommend actually get people to report being happier.
That's right. I think the word argue is used by scientists as, I think it just means, you know, we say or we propose. But yeah, so because we never think anything is proven.
In a minute, let's get back to what specifically to do to be happier. You're listening to Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. I have a free gift for my listeners. I found that people often have some unconscious beliefs that get in the way of thinking, feeling, looking, and being as youthful as possible. So I developed a set of 6 anti-aging hypnosis CDs. Most people use them when they're going to sleep at night. It helps them profoundly relax and drift off to sleep while they effortlessly absorb the suggestions. And to add to it, John David Jones, a musician to the stars, recorded original 4-track music that just hugs my words. So if you want to get an extra advantage on being more youthful, all you have to do is send a comment about the program to radio@agelesslifestyles.com, and I'll send you the link so you can download an MP3 of the first CD. And we're talking with Professor Sonia Lubomirsky, who is a professor of psychology at University of California, Riverside, and the author of The How of Happiness. You can find the book on thehowofhappiness.com or, of course, on amazon.com. You also have a blog on psychologytoday.com.
That's right. People can just go to psychologytoday.com and click on blog, and you will find me.
Your wonderful book weaves in the research support, but it's a very readable book and very practical how-to guide to be happier. It's really the best research-based tool out there for making for a happier life. I love it.
Thank you very much.
What is your favorite strategy for that 40%?
Good question. You know, I talk a lot about the importance of fit, is that certain strategies are going to fit more some people than others. And so it's going to be different for different people. I guess for myself, I think I would have to say that living in the present is my favorite strategy. And maybe it's because I'm not as good at it. I'm a very future-oriented person. You know, I'm very busy, lots of things that I'm doing at the same time. And so it's hard for me to just relax and really savor the present moment, like when I'm with my little kids. As I was writing the book, a lot of it rubbed off on my daily life. And so I really tried to use some of those savoring strategies.
And so you said that was one of the things that the research changed your life and helped you be happier.
Exactly. I mean, just writing the book meant that I had to do a lot of reading and thinking and learning about different strategies. And so, yeah, I ended up using them myself. So on the chapter on relationships, I had lots of strategies that I talked about how people can enhance their relationships. And I ended up using them on my husband. I didn't even realize I was doing it.
So what does a person do to live more in the present?
A lot of it is sort of common sense. So, for example, one strategy is to focus on the senses, smell, taste, hearing, sight, and to really, when you're walking to work or you're on your way somewhere, to really, like you were talking about looking up at rooftops, to really smell the trees or the flowers or look at the clouds. And when you're eating your breakfast, to really focus on the crunchiness or the taste of the food. I mean, to really savor. When you're taking a shower, to savor the feeling of the water.
And we don't have to do yoga to do that.
No. Some people might want to do yoga, and then others will not find that a fitting activity.
It's interesting to me that getting people out of panic attacks or anxiety, one of the best ways is to get them to focus on their sensory experience and get outside of their head and outside of their body.
Yes, that's very consistent with the researchers saying about being out in nature, you know, makes people happier. And not just being outside, it's really appreciating that. I mean, a lot of people go through the days of, you know, they're not really looking and hearing and smelling. And so it's really to use your senses in sort of a maximal way.
We have so much sound around us and experience around us that we're used to tuning things out and just having things be Muzak, even if it's Beethoven.
That's right, and that's very adaptive. I mean, we have to be able to filter things out. So I think what people would want to do if they want to be happier is to notice what they are lacking. And maybe if you're the kind of person who's already can smell the roses, then that's not something you need to do, and you might want to take up another strategy. Maybe it's forgiveness or gratitude.
So if somebody wants to work the system, be happier, would you start with an assessment?
Yes, they should measure their happiness levels, and there's various measures or scales. And that's important because you want to track that over time. So you want to track how happy you are maybe once a month or, you know, however often you want. In my book, I also have a person activity fit diagnostic or scale, and that's going to help you determine which strategies you should work on. I've actually got an email saying, your book is the first How to Be Happy book that helped me. The other books, I'd be so excited about everything, and I'd just be overwhelmed. But when you take this diagnostic, it'll tell you which are the 1, 2, 3, or 4 strategies that are the best fitting strategies for you, and then you just focus on those at first and ignore the rest.
By best fit, do you mean which strategy to focus on, or do you mean within that strategy how to go about achieving it?
It's actually both. The fit diagnostic is about which strategy to focus on. So it's going to tell you, you know, for you, it's going to be gratitude, physical activity, and meditation. Those are the 3, or maybe there are 4. And then once you decide, okay, I'm going to try those, say, 2 at a time, or you could just try 1 at a time, then there's also different ways that you can try each of those strategies. So if it's going to be physical activity, of course, there's many different ways to practice that. And then you want to choose something that you think would feel natural to you, that you would enjoy, that you'll maintain doing.
Do you choose to go with your strengths or your weaknesses?
Both. I think, you know, some positive psychologists argue that you should focus on your strengths, and I think it really depends. I mean, for some people, like I was saying to you, that I really need to live more in the present. I mean, that's a weakness, and that's what I've been working on. Other people might want to focus on their strengths. So the conclusion really is there are different kinds of fit. You know, there could be fit with your strengths or fit with your weaknesses, or it could be fit with your lifestyle or fit with your personality. So if you're a generally extroverted person, for example, you might choose strategies that get you in touch with other people. And if you're an introverted person, maybe you want to do strategies that does force you to talk to people every day. Or I shouldn't say that, because I think talking to people every day is a very good thing that makes people happier. But the idea is that there's different kinds of fit, and people really have a lot of latitude to choose based on what they think would work best for them.
So the introvert might get on a committee or get active in a professional organization, whereas the extrovert can just go out and party.
Yeah, exactly. Unless the introvert wants to be more extroverted, then they might want to work on that.
But you emphasize that you can't cut corners on the physical well-being, that if you don't exercise, if you don't eat reasonably well, there's plenty of research showing that you're going to end up unhappier.
That's right. I mean, the physical part is important. I talk about the importance of sleep, the importance of exercise. As you know, they really go together. The emotional well-being and the physical well-being really go hand in hand. And the happier you are, the stronger your immune system is going to be, the stronger your health is going to be. So there's kind of a bi-directional relationship there between health and emotional well-being.
One of the things you were concerned about was that people might see the recommendations as corny. My take on it was that the difference between corny and what you did was that you really drilled down into the details of what to do.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. I think, I don't know, some people think that I emphasize the corniness aspect too much, but there's enough people who just will never pick up a book like this because they see the strategy. So you should count your blessings more, and they think that's all corny and hokey and sound trite. Didn't want that to be a barrier for readers. So if you're someone who thinks these things are corny, I think it's important to really look at the evidence and the research. A lot of evidence supports these strategies. As you say, there's lots of different ways to do them. There's a lot of details in how to approach each of the strategies. And so yeah, I hope that is not a barrier for people.
So if you want to count your blessings more, there's half a dozen different ways to do it, and probably one that would fit for you.
Exactly.
What else would you like us to know about how to be happier?
We covered a lot of the main points that I'd like to make. Just would want to reiterate the importance of fit, again, the importance that you choose well, and also the importance of effort. That if you want to be happier and your set point for happiness is lower than you like, you really need to put a lot of effort into it. Now, that effort could be really thrilling and fun and fulfilling. It's not like cleaning the bathroom, but it's necessary. And so there's no magic, no solution. There's no secret to happiness. It's just doing strategies and really maintaining them on a lasting way. Perhaps every day for the rest of your life, you will want to be doing these things.
So it's like physical fitness. You have to work at it, and yet if you find the strategies that you feel comfortable with, that you enjoy doing anyway, it's not that much work. Whereas if you just get into a Procrustean bed and say, this is the strategy I have to use in order to be happier, you may end up sabotaging the whole process.
And, you know, it's very similar with exercise and dieting. I mean, I started running years ago, and at first it was really hard, and it was a chore, and I didn't want to do it. It takes a while before it really becomes a habit and you start to enjoy it. And so now I feel bad when I don't go running. And And I would hope that that's what happened, will happen with a lot of people if they, let's say they decide to try to be more grateful every day and maybe set aside some time every day to be grateful. I think after a while, I bet that person is going to feel like their day isn't going to go as well if they don't do that gratitude strategy. So it really becomes woven into the fabric of your life, and you become used to it and you really enjoy it.
Is optimism a linchpin for all of these other attitudes, or is it just that I've read so much Martin Seligman's research?
Sure. There are some of the strategies that are more linchpins than others, and I wouldn't necessarily say optimism, but I would say positive thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because optimism is just one form of positive thinking. But positive thinking really is critical. And if you read my book, you'll notice that it's related to many of the strategies that I talk about. When I talk about gratitude, obviously a lot of gratitude is positively thinking about what you have, appreciating what you have. Forgiveness involves a more of a charitable or positive reinterpretation of maybe something bad that someone has done. Positive thinking is important in relationships as well. So it is a linchpin for many of the other strategies.
So you're defining positive thinking much more broadly than just the Dale Carnegie or the every day and every way I'm getting better kind of bromides.
Exactly, yeah. It is much more broad. It involves how you feel about yourself, about other people. But optimism is very important, and it's just one form of positive thinking. It's really positive thinking about your future, that things will turn out okay.
What kind of research are you working on now?
Lots of things. I'm still doing happiness interventions. I'll tell you about a couple of studies we just finished. We just finished a cross-cultural study where we did an intervention where people either wrote gratitude letters or they kept optimism journals, best possible selves journals, I call them, or they were in a control condition, and we compared Asian Americans and Anglo-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting. We found that everyone benefited from the intervention, from trying to be more grateful or optimistic, but the Anglo-Americans benefited more and got happier and put more effort into it. And so we're trying to explore that further, what it is about Asian culture. The Asian Americans actually benefited more in some different ways in their relationships, so their relationships were affected. But cultural differences are very important. I mean, I think the desire and the pursuit of happiness is really universal, but people across different cultures just do it differently. So maybe it's another of a fit issue, that it might be more fitting for some cultures to do certain kinds of strategies or to do them in a certain way. And then can I tell you about my other study?
Sure, please.
And then another study we just finished, but we don't have the data, but we were very excited about it. We were interested in the placebo effect, and that idea that, well, maybe the happiness strategies work just because you think they're going to work, right? So you think that counting your blessings is going to make you happy, and even if it doesn't really work, just like a sugar pill, it's going to make you happier. We had a gratitude group who wrote gratitude letters, and we either told them there's a lot of evidence that gratitude is going to work, or we told them actually there's evidence that gratitude does not work, and it helps other aspects of your life, but not happiness. And then we also had a control condition, which we call a placebo condition, where we asked people to listen to classical music. Now, I love classical music, but I don't think it's a happiness strategy. I mean, it could be for some people, I suppose. But we either told people listening to classical music every week is going to make you happier, or it's not going to make you happier. And so we're going to see what the results are. We're sort of very excited to find out.
That's fascinating. One of the things I was impressed, too, was you talked about habits and how one of the things that often sabotages them are that it gets monotonous. And so part of what you recommend is strategies to make sure that it doesn't get monotonous.
That's right. The spicing things up with a bit of variety is very important. And it's very interested now in the phenomenon of adaptation. You know, how do people adapt to positive things and how can we slow that down or forestall it? One really effective technique is through variety, sort of doing things different ways. And again, kind of like a fitness program, if you exercise in the exact same way, the same time every day, that might become more monotonous.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so it's using variety, and it's a little surprise as well. And it works in relationships. You know, if there's no surprises left in a relationship, if there's no variety, right, it's not going to be as satisfying.
So one of the things you're recommending is that in addition to the assessing and working some strategies, that people also monitor whether there's enough variety and how they're using the strategies.
That's right. And I've done some studies where actually ask people to say, do acts of kindness, but either vary them, do different things every week, or do the same sort of things every week, and people get happier when they do different things, and they don't get happier when they do the same thing kind of over and over again. And so, yeah, it's very important to monitor whether you're doing things with some variety.
When we look at this as a whole, some people may look at the 50% genetic and say, oh, geez, you know, the glass is half empty. But the 40% is still a huge part of happiness and can make just a huge difference in people's lives.
That's right. That's one reason that I put this model together, this sort of pie chart, you know, the 50% genetics, 10% situations, and 40% sort of what's under your control. Because I think that really is a very simple picture, but it tells people really quickly, you know, yes, it's true that what my life is like is going to determine in part how happy I am and what my genes are. But then the 40% number is really pretty big, and I hope that will inspire people to do something about their happiness if that's what they've always wanted to do.
And that 40% will probably pull the 10% some as well, in that if you're doing these strategies, some of your life circumstances are probably going to improve as well.
That's exactly right. And in fact, all three of those factors, the situations, the genes, and the activities, interact or influence each other. It's a little bit actually simplistic to separate them out the way I did, but they're going to all affect each other, and there's something that's going to happen, which is called an upward spiral. You try a happiness strategy that actually improves your circumstances, which makes you even happier. Maybe that even turns on some happiness genes. I mean, that's the part we don't really know much about, which makes you even happier. And so it's an upward spiral. That's what you want to aim for.
So we can leverage our 40%.
That's right.
What a deal.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to share with us?
Not really. This has been a great conversation. Lots of really good questions. I hope that your listeners will find some strategies that fit them and that they'll make them happy.
They know where to go to find them. We've been talking with University of California Riverside Professor Sonia Lubomirsky, author of The How of Happiness. Her book is at thehowofhappiness.com, or you can check out amazon.com. And she also has a blog at psychologytoday.com. It's a wonderful book and so refreshing to see research support instead of just what somebody thinks. Thank you very much for a fascinating interview.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure to do this.
I like to leave you with a baby step to help you live longer, healthier, and happier. My baby step today is, oddly enough, to set a low standard for happiness. In one of my first jobs, I was director of a sheltered workshop for people with mental retardation, developmental disabilities. Some of the adults were pretty capable and could do competitive employment with training, and some were very limited and were just doing arts and crafts. Ralph was an African-American who was crippled with cerebral palsy. His muscles were very contracted, and his speech was practically unintelligible. And yet, he was one of the most upbeat people I ever have known. Somewhere along the line, somebody attached a paintbrush to his safety helmet, and Ralph began to paint. And they were the most cheerful, upbeat, life-enhancing watercolors you've ever seen. They were at a very childlike level of development, perhaps that of an 8-year-old, but just seeing them would cheer you up. And indeed, Ralph's disposition was one of the sunniest dispositions I've ever seen. Well, eventually, Ralph got written up in the newspaper, and eventually he got a one-man exhibition in a local art gallery. And one of the watercolors on my wall is a genuine Ralph Bell. Just looking at it reminds me that it doesn't need to take much to make you happy. We're often tempted to say, hey, I'll be happy if I get this report done, or get to play a round of golf, or get a commission today. Making that a condition for whether we'll be happy or not is setting ourselves up for unhappiness. Yes, we need to have goals, but our happiness doesn't have to be linked to whether we achieve those goals or not. If you think about Maria in the musical The Sound of Music, she has that wonderful song, Raindrops and Roses and Whiskers on Kitten. She has a whole long list of things that just seeing them makes her happy. The longer your list is, or the more you notice little things that make you happy, the more likely you are to be happy. A little sunshine, a flower, a hug, a robin, a kind word from somebody. That should be more than sufficient to make you happy, even make your day. I'd like you to say to yourself, it doesn't take much to make me happy. Did that sound natural or uncomfortable? If it sounds unnatural, you need to say it more often to the point where it does feel comfortable. It does feel like you. And when you achieve that, you're helping yourself be happier. As Abraham Lincoln put it, most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be, to setting a low standard for happiness. And the strategies that Dr. Lobomirsky talked about help you know how to be happier. So set a low standard of happiness for yourself. I'd also like to point out that you probably pay thousands of dollars a year for insurance, but there's one form of insurance that you get absolutely free that you probably never realized. You see, one of the implications of the set point for happiness is that if adversity comes in your life, let's say you get a divorce or you lose a job or you lose some money, before long you're likely to return to your previous level of happiness, which hopefully will be even enhanced by the kind of strategies that Dr. Lobomirsky talked about today. So when you're thinking about what kind of insurance you have, you can put happiness insurance on the list too as a free bonus. In response to our show last week on Boomers and Seniors Can Find True Love, I received several emails of people telling me how they found love in middle age or even in their senior years. I had one friend tell me that she frequently visited a nursing home and one of the residents there was 98 years old and pretty good health, but was blind. And he fell in love with another resident and they were passionately in love with each other, fondly in love with each other, and wanted to get married. As it would have it, his 70-some-year-old kids objected to them getting married. Now, he gave in and said, well, if they don't want us to get married, we won't, but that's not going to stop our love. Personally, I would have preferred that he had been more assertive and said, well, it's up to us whether we get married or not, not our kids. If you can't be assertive at 98, when are you going to be assertive? But I think it's a wonderful example of how you can find true love at any age. This is Dr. Michael Bricky on WebTalkRadio.net, thanking you for joining us on our journey to think, feel, look, and be more youthful. And remember to get your free MP3 download of my anti-aging hypnosis. Just send a comment about the program to radio@agelesslifestyles.com, and I'll send you the link. That's agelesslifestyles.com. See you next week, and keep the emails coming.